This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
When we talk about human intelligence, what are we talking about?
So let's start by intelligence. So when we talk about intelligence, we talk about the ability to find a solution to a new problem that the organism who performs the intelligent action has never encountered before. So it's a situation to which this organism hasn't been prepared and for which it then finds spontaneously a solution that is actually in accordance with the needs of the organism and that satisfies the need of the organism. So basically, this is the important part. Is must be novel. The organism must not have been prepared for it. It must not have been trained for it. So it must be able to react to a completely new situation. And this animals are able to do. And now to come to your question, humans as well, but humans can also verbalize it. So they can also use language to solve problems. So they can formulate and solve more difficult problems than animals can because they have language and because they can distance themselves also from the immediate needs. Otherwise, there would be no physicists, right? They would only eat and hunt, you know. So we can distance ourselves from our immediate needs, but then we can use language also to solve more difficult problems. But what we do is in essence the same as animals do. We find solutions to new problems that we haven't encountered before.
And that ultimately is why you argue that AI or machines will never take over.
Yes, because so in the book is called Why Machines Will Never Rule the World. And the fundamental reason is that we don't know how intelligence comes about. We don't know how it works. And so therefore we cannot engineer it by planning it. However, you could argue, yeah, we can. And so what I just said rules out a planned engineering of intelligence because we don't know how this works, how we find solutions to new problems. Now, the second argument of the book goes against the idea that you can train a machine to become intelligent. And to refute this is much more complicated. And I can try to give a sketch of this if you're interested in that. Mm. But the first argument is just that we don't know how intelligence comes about, but if you want to build a bridge, you need to understand the causalities and to build the bridge and the statics, and then you can build it. And when you engineer something, you need to understand how it works. So if you want to engineer with a plan, you can't engineer intelligence. Now, can you engineer it by imitation of what humans and animals do? That's the second question that is a little harder to answer.
Well, try and answer it.
So, okay, so what animals and humans do is the behavior of a complex system. That's a term from thermodynamics, which is a branch of physics, which that's very interesting because though it is a branch of physics that has allowed us, for example, to build refrigerators and heat pumps and so on, it's also the part of physics that was invented in the 19th century, which gives a lot of negative answers. So because from thermodynamics, you can derive system theory and complex system theory, and then you see suddenly, and also chaos theory is also related to this, and then you can suddenly see for which parts of nature we cannot find equations of physics. And then you realize that almost all of nature is cannot be modeled with equations as we do in physics. And so there are two ways of finding equations. One way is to make experiments or observations and look at the data, how they relate, and to imitate this relationship in the equation, which is what Newton did when he found the law of gravitation, or what also did Schrödinger did when he thought of the Schrödinger equation for quantum mechanics. Or that's one way, and that's a traditional way that physicists have used, since Galileo more or less invented modern physics. But there's also another way, which is called machine learning, where you use data to derive an equation that is super complicated, and that is called, I call this implicit mathematics. Then you automatically derive an equation. And now the question is, can we not observe human behavior and record a lot of human behavior and then basically derive an equation that mimics human intelligence, right? Then we would have artificial intelligence using implicit mathematics, and we would not have to understand how we engineer the machine that is intelligent, but we would just learn it, so to speak, from observing what the human does. And this would be the way to create, that's what they dream of at OpenAI. Mm.
What is artificial intelligence?
So artificial intelligence, in my view, would be the ability to have a machine or another artificial entity, but artificial entities are always machines, that basically because we cannot create life de novo, right? So we can, well, it could be a machine or it could even be an altered organism. But for now, let's say with a machine that can be put into any, in a new situation that it has never encountered before and then perform a useful action in this novel situation, which it never encountered before. And useful would have to be defined in a certain way. It couldn't be useful to itself because a machine doesn't have a self, but that's a different question, but it could also be useful for some other purpose. And so that would be an artificially intelligent machine because it would also do what intelligent organisms do.
So could it be argued that artificial intelligence, as we understand it currently, is basically just a collection of algorithms?
Yes. So, of course, it's just a marketing label that was invented to get funding in the 1950s, right? In Dartmouth conference in 56 or so, it was invented by computer scientists who wanted to have more funding. And so they said, let's claim that we can build artificial intelligence. And then they indeed received a lot of funding. But what artificial intelligence is nowadays is a collection of algorithms. And these algorithms, and that's the important thing, are carefully prepared to solve a certain problem. For example, the chess winning algorithm that IBM made, Deep Blue, that it made in the 80s, was carefully programmed to search the solution space for chess, and to then, it was able to search it more comprehensively than a human being and therefore beat the human being. Because you can formulate the problem of winning chess as a search through a solution space. And because computers are very good at that, they designed an algorithm that can search the space for the chess game, and then you can beat any human being. And so are all artificial intelligence systems that are run now. They are all designed for and very carefully built and tested for a certain situation. And they are also trained heavily. So all of this is, of course, contradicting the definition of intelligence that the machine, if it would be intelligent, would be able to cope with a completely new situation. But what happens is that if you put a so-called AI machine in a completely new situation, it must fail by definition. It will always fail. And therefore, it's not intelligent.
Yeah, your example of Deep Blue versus Kasparov, I think it was, is a great one, because that is a predefined set of possible outcomes. There are millions of outcomes, but there are a predetermined set of outcomes. But if you're talking about human interaction, there are no predetermined set of outcomes.
Yeah, so what you're alluding to is technically called the difference between a closed world and open world problem. And closed world problems are all amenable to AI. And closed world problems are also all amenable to mathematics. And therefore, in the end, AI is always applied mathematics. And so AI is very good if you have regular patterns and recurring patterns. They can be very subtle, but they must be recurring and regular. And if you have that, then you can find equations either explicitly or implicitly that basically model this recurrence and this regularity, and then you can calculate it very well. In closed world systems, that's always possible. That's why also machines always now can beat human beings at ego shooter games, because ego shooter games are also closed world situations. Now, when you get out of this into the real world, now you have the following. I want to get back once more to thermodynamics. Then you have complex systems. And complex systems, all animate systems like humans, animals, and so on, are complex systems. Also plants are insects and so on. But also nature itself, inanimate nature, also consists of complex systems. And when these complex systems, they have essential properties. So that means defining properties, which make it impossible to create comprehensive mathematical models for them. And because of this, ultimately, we cannot create a mathematical model of intelligence because it's a complex, very, very complex system. And we know from thermodynamics that for complex systems, we must just give up. So we can only, that's why we also don't have, for example, climate models that are valid, right? Because the climate is a complex system. And so we can only select a small proportion, for example, the ocean cycle, heat, cold, and then model a part of the ocean cycle mathematically. But we can never obtain a comprehensive model, a holistic model, and that's you know, or synoptic model, as we call it in the book, and that's why we can't in the end create artificial intelligence.
Yeah, in your book, you ask the question: what is the end goal of AI?
Yes.
And so, what is it? Is it just to solve problems?
Yeah, so the end goal of AI from those who believe in it, like Sam Altman, is to create a machine intelligence that surpasses the intelligence of the human being. From my perspective, the goal of AI is much more modest. For me, it's part of the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution is the application of mathematics and physics and engineering and all the disciplines derived from it, like chemistry, to change the environment of mankind so that mankind can live more easily. Right. And so central heating is an example. Right. And many others, the car, the telephone, the technology we're using now. And so for me, AI is just a part of applying mathematics to improve the environment for the needs of human beings. And if you're cynical, you could say to exploit human beings better. But basically, the real reason is to improve how human beings can live. And that's the purpose of culture. You see, so AI is a part, in the largest sense, culture replaces. Animals have instincts and predefined patterns with how they interact with the environment. We don't have this anymore, so we need culture which replaces the loss of instincts. And AI is a very sophisticated part of culture, which has the aim to improve the way we can live in nature.
And I guess on a day-to-day experience, things like attraction, love, hatred, all those kinds of things, those do not fit into algorithms.
Yes, so these are other properties of the human mind. So this is very important. So the human mind doesn't only consist of abstract problem solving. It has many, many other features, all of which we don't understand how they come about. We don't understand how emotions come about, or something like motivation, that you are that you want to get up in the morning and do something. We don't understand. We don't understand consciousness, right? So even which is the most basic property of the human mind, because without consciousness, you can do anything. And so that's a precondition of all our acts is consciousness, and so basically, of a willful act at least. You can be a sleepwalker, but that's a different topic. But basically, it's consciousness, and we don't know how this comes about. We cannot model it. We cannot engineer it, for the same reasons why we cannot engineer artificial intelligence. And therefore we cannot engineer a person. We cannot engineer a human being, because all of this we don't understand how it comes about.
Okay, so. Basically, what you're saying is that there's no logical way in which artificial intelligence can surpass that of human intelligence.
There's also no stochastic way. So very importantly, the AI camp is divided in stochastic and deterministic AI, or logic AI. So the Kasparov beating or Karpov beating computer was rules-based, it was a logic AI, but there's also stochastic AI. All the large language models, what OpenAI is making, ChatGPT, and what Google is, a competition by Google, it's all stochastic AI. It's based on probabilistics. And also this stochastic AI cannot surmount human intelligence, because it can only solve the problem that it was trained for and nothing else. So for example, a large language model is, you can now train it to have a very high IQ in an IQ test. But if you introduce a test of intelligence that is totally different to the tests that are published, it will also fail on that one. So it's, you can only train it to be good at what is already known. But because, yes.
I was going to say, but a major criticism, which even Elon Musk has brought up, is that it's a type of neurolinguistic technology that seems to learn and adapt.
So this is an argument that is actually naive, because the machine doesn't learn. It's basically, they confound a shortcut with an argument. To say learn when you talk about a computer is to say that you are parameterizing a very large equation automatically. So what these large language models are, they are huge equations, an algorithm, very sophisticated algorithm, is run to parameterize them. They have billions of parameters, and these parameters have to be set to a certain value. And when you have achieved this, you can then use the model like you are using ChatGPT. But it then has, and then you can of course add more data and run it again and change the parameters again. This way, you can teach ChatGPT quote unquote new events, right? So if you froze its training data by mid of last year, and now you retrain it with the data until Christmas of last year, then it will also know about the facts that happened in between. But that doesn't mean it's learned. It's just reparameterized by human beings by giving it a huge amount of data. So Elon Musk's, he doesn't understand the mathematics. So he thinks learning, he takes it in a literal sense like humans learn. But machines don't learn like humans. They just get reparameterized in their models. And so now comes one very important aspect of the book. Reparameterizing a model means just changing the inner logic of the model, but it remains a logic model, even if it's stochastically obtained. Whereas a human mind is not a logic model, it's a logic system, it's a complex system. And you can never create a mathematical model that is like a complex system. And so therefore, yes, you can readapt it all the time, but it will never gain the properties of a complex system, and it will never be on top of things because it's always lagging behind and can always only do what it was programmed for. And the programming can be explicit, like in the very classical computer programming, or it can be implicit, like DeepMind or OpenAI are doing it, but it's still a way of programming a computer to do a repetitive task.
So it's not proactive.
No, it can't be, because it can only repeat. The parameterization can only model repetitive patterns. And so, for example, each human conversation, this conversation now has already had several aspects I didn't expect. And this is typical for human conversations, that it's irregular. And this irregularity makes human interactions interesting and also possible, because if human beings hate regularities, we are living on change. Even people who don't seem to live on change, they need something new, they need a challenge, and otherwise people suffer. So that's why routine work is not good for anyone. It's okay, if you work 6 or 8 hours a day on routine work to make a living, but then you need something else. And so this is part of, also for animals, part of our existence is to want to be to be confronted with new situations. That's why we like fiction so much, right? Mm-hmm. And because fiction provides this, and good fiction can provide something totally unexpected. And machines can only work with regularities. And that's why chatbots don't work. Chatbots can only, cover the part of a conversation that occur very frequently. But very quickly they fail because the path taken by the conversation is not foreseeable.
Okay, so then what are those fears that people have? What are those fears grounded on? I mean, we know that the world is heading towards a more technocratic, centralized system in which science and technology are going to be used to infiltrate our personal lives. I mean, are those not valid?
So the fear, totally valid. So we have since the 18th century, when Bentham described the panopticon, there has been this goal of elites to get control over everything. Michel Foucault wrote an important book about, I don't like Michel Foucault much, but he wrote an important book in the 70s called Surveiller et Punir, that means supervise and punish, about all of this. I can still recommend it, though it has weaknesses, but the core is quite good. And so this is, of course, what the modern age is about, but artificial intelligence is only a small part of this, because it's so limited in what it can do. So most of the technocracy that we are more and more faced with comes from digitization and artificial intelligence. So digitization, the ability to record everything and to trace every movement and to know what people are doing online and offline and so on, this ability is very threatening, because, for example, now, what does AI do in this? For example, if you have face recognition, you need an AI algorithm to find the face. Now, if a person covers his face, the person might believe that he or she is now protected against face recognition, but the computer can then identify you by your gait, by the way, the style in which you walk. And this is also perfectly individual. So you can have an AI also detecting you based on the way you move. And so this is the part where AI is being used. But for the more complicated patterns, like what we say and how we interact, AI is useless to really do a lot. So there you still need human beings who will do the supervision and interpretation of what we are saying. And so the threat is more coming from digitization and control over the access to digital goods, like shopping online, booking tickets, being able to get services also from the administration. The classical means of repression come from restricting access. And if you can do this via digital means, that's so much easier to turn somebody off or to turn off groups of people from access. And so restriction of access has always been the main way to rule people, because it's much easier than killing them or harming them. This is the last, measure you want to take is actually violence. But before that, there are many other ways to control. And all of these can also be executed in the digital world. So the real threat is not AI, but the digital world. And within the digital world, AI plays a certain role as an adjuvant instrument, but only that. It's not, and the fear comes from a misapprehension of AI. So people believe that machines can think and that therefore, for example, they can supervise, machines could supervise this conversation and so on, but they cannot. Only humans can. And so therefore, what you have is a misproportion. On the one hand, you have a huge pile of data that comes from the digital infrastructure. And on the other hand, you still have, you know, only an innumerable amount of Secret Service people who supervise us and police people. And it's like in the German Democratic Republic, you know, the limitation where the number of people that were supervising the others. And it's still like this.
But what about this? I mean, this device has become so integral to our existence. It even predicts what we're going to do next. And it helps us make decisions. And not just that, it starts manipulating the data that is given to us so that we can feed into a particular set of agendas or narratives without even knowing it. Is that not dangerous?
Yes, it's very dangerous. And he was holding up the mobile phone, by the way, for those who only listen. Yes, so the ubiquitous usage of mobile phones is very dangerous because it cannot only supervise what you're doing, but it can also, if you are not very careful in its usage, make preselections of what you see, right? As this is happening, of course, at Facebook, on Twitter, X, YouTube, and everywhere. So I'm not using any of these, right? So I don't care. but for those who use them a lot, it's very manipulative, and you can see it from talking to people who have, for example, no awareness of the crisis of Western democracies, for whom COVID was, for example, a great, you know, thing that the state saved us all, and who think that basically our goal must be to beat Russia and split it up in 15 parts, and all these who believe in these narratives. If you talk to them, you realize that they don't get any other information because they have been using the same sources forever, and they have not seen that these sources lack anything because they live in a protected environment. So this works very well. Now, how did it work 500 years ago? Well, with the church, you know? So basically, there have always been technologies to make people believe in certain narratives, but now it has become, in a way, more subtle and also more pervasive and more intense. So I agree with that, but it has not much to do with artificial intelligence, but rather with digitization.
I see what you're saying. But yes, okay, but one of your fundamental arguments is that machines won't rule the world. But is that not a form of ruling?
Yeah, the rulers are human beings, right? And they have certain interests. And what are they about power? What is power? Power is ability to be able to, from a limited number of resources, to get more resources for one to pursue one's own goals. And this can be very extreme. And the people pursue power, and they program the machines. They have people program the machines for them. And like we know from the Twitter files, how Twitter was reprogrammed to delete all the COVID critical content and so on. And so this is a form of rule, but the rule is not done by the machines, but via the machine. And so this is, of course, you know, it's a big difference who is commanding the army and what the army is doing, right? And so the soldier fighting in Napoleon's army was a tool. But he was not ruling or waging war. The war was waged by Napoleon using the army, using the manufacturing power of France to build weapons and equipment. But basically, there's a big difference between the when you kill somebody with a hammer, the hammer is not killing.
Yes, that's a very good point. And I suppose something else that feeds into what you're saying is that machines will always require energy, resources.
Yes.
And they can't exactly go and build their own factories.
Yeah, so people are arguing that this might be the case and so on. But this is, of course, all assumes a lot of things that machines don't have. Machines don't have a will. We cannot make them have a will. They can have no intentions. It's all of this is the same argument why there cannot be machine intelligence. Also true for personality, will, intentions, consciousness. All of this would require, it's anthropomorphism. This is like the Greeks imagined the gods to look like them, just a bit more beautiful and muscular. Athena was a beautiful woman with super proportions, wearing this helmet, and Zeus was, you know, Superman and so on. But they looked like humans, right? And now people imagine, who don't know mathematics and physics, they imagine machines are like humans. It's just nonsense. It's funny because if you know mathematics and physics, I don't know any mathematician or physicist who believes in this. No serious person. All the people who believe in it are engineers. They lack the mathematical education. Or they have very little of it, like Bill Gates. I think Bill Gates did never finish his bachelor. Elon Musk has only a bachelor. Many of them are just, you know, don't have enough education to see this. It's really a matter of knowledge. They know too little. And so therefore, you know, they overestimate this. And they are, in a way, naive. And they are also, you know, Cartesians and positivists. They believe in this eternal progress of technology. They don't see the essential limitations of technology because they extrapolate the speed of evolution of technology from 1850 to 1990 or 2000 to the future. But it's actually going to level off. And the reason why it's going to level off is that we have exploited a lot of the insights of physics, and that physics is now struggling since 1970, really struggling to come up with new models. And so the models that were made before in physics, we have utilized them as technology more and more and more. There are still sweet spots that can be exploited, but it's getting harder and harder.
What about unintended consequences?
Of what?
Of AI.
Yeah, so there are many, like with every technology, right? So this is a very interesting keyword that I have not heard anyone ask me. So that's a very good question. So whenever you introduce technology, you are into a social system, you have unintended consequences of the technology. And of course, AI has this as well, right? And these unintended consequences may not always be at all in the interest of the person who introduced the technology. Right. So I don't think that the combustion engine and the car based on it was really mainly introduced to enhance personal liberty or anything, or to, let's say, allow terrorism with car bombs. Right. So, there's always plenty of usage of technology in society that is not intended and it's not plannable. This has to do with the fact that societies are systems of complex systems and that you cannot plan them. You can introduce something and then you have to see what happens. And sometimes you have to prohibit it again because it's too dangerous. Like heroin, you know, heroin was freely available in 1905. It was actually used as an anti-coughing drug for children. Then children died of it, you know, and others became addicted. And then at some point, it was clear that it should be regulated. And so this is always the case with technologies. Now, for AI, there are multiple unintended consequences, which are very hard to predict. But the most important one is certainly, and there is the most threatening one, is the usage of AI in warfare. So this is the most serious consequence, which is very rarely discussed. And I believe that in warfare, AI can be so detrimental that it's the only part where we need real regulation of AI, because in warfare, AI can be as dangerous as the use of atomic, biological or chemical weapons. So there it is super dangerous. And I think that we will have to regulate it like we have regulated the ABC weapons. And many people don't understand this yet.
How will AI be bad in war?
So if you look at the Ukraine war, which is now the most modern war that is currently fought, both sides are heavily using defensive AI systems. So there are two classes. One class is detection. So they have a lot of sensors everywhere in the sky, I mean, in the stratosphere, but satellites, but also on the ground, vibration detectors, I mean, cameras, drones filming, sound recording, electromagnetic waves, the full spectrum. And all of this is of course, calculated and integrated with AI to distill signals, meaningful signals from these millions of data points that are recorded every minute or every second. So both sides have a lot of AI on the defensive side, which has changed the way this war is conducted. And then and changed the role of certain battle units. I'm not an expert, but military experts tell me that the warfare has totally changed. And then there's, of course, offensive weaponry. And in offensive weaponry, you have also AI. And this can be terrible. Like you can have loitering munitions, which are like drones, which are on the ground, which are programmed to just rise up and kill everything that moves when something comes that moves. These are like very, very efficient minds, you know. But you cannot avoid them. And so all of this time, or you can imagine such drones attacking a town and killing everybody in town. So, and though it's harder to build offensive AI than defensive AI, you can imagine these weapons as very smart bombs. And that will be able to destroy, to basically fly into a town and just destroy life in this town very efficiently within minutes, you know. And I think, whereas doing this via an air raid takes days or months, you know, like you saw in Gaza, how long it took, how many tons of missiles they had to throw onto Gaza to turn it into rubble. And so this is what I'm talking about. And this has not been seen so much by the public, but it will become visible and will create outrage and will hopefully lead to regulation of AI weaponry.
But the overarching point that you have been making is that even that will not dominate. It still relies on humans.
Always. There is no... The thing is, a tool cannot have an ego. A tool cannot act, right? Mm-hmm. And moral responsibility can only be attributed to an actor. If you have a dog that bites a human being, you are not blaming the dog. You are blaming the owner of the dog who let it loose, you know? And so this is the right way to look at it. There is the only way to have responsibility is to have a will. Even if you are, you know, if you are mentally handicapped and have an IQ under 70, you will not be charged for your acts, right? Nobody will make you responsible. And this is a fundamental principle of all human societies, that responsible actors cannot be imbecile. You know, and so basically machines are just repeating patterns that they're programmed to do, so they will always remain tools. And therefore, the danger comes from those who engineer the machines and program them and decide what the machines should be doing.
Yeah, okay, but all right, so let's just stay on that point for a moment. The efficiency of computer learning, right, is that not an exponential growth? I mean, can that not reach a point where it can appear to be on par or more advanced with your thinking?
Yeah, so that would be the case. Now we have to come to one core property of complex systems. This is non-ergodicity. So non-ergodicity means that the probability of the particles of the system, or the microstates, as it's called, of a system, is never equal in all the parts of the system. So when you look at this bottle of water, if it's at constant temperature and at rest, the probability of measuring a concentration of the water molecules is everywhere the same in the bottle. That's called ergodicity. And when you have ergodicity, you can create models of systems. So this is the Boltzmann, the foundation of the Boltzmann mechanics in physics. And when you have non-ergodicity, like when I shake the bottle, you can make an infinite amount of pictures, but you will never be able to predict what's going on, because you have turbulence. And therefore you can, for example, record as many human conversations as you want. You will never teach a computer how to speak, because the variation is infinite because of the non-ergodicity of the way that humans conduct conversations. Therefore you cannot train it. Adding more data material will not improve it. And we see this already with ChatGPT and other large language models. They are not improving anymore, because all the texts of the internet have been put into them. They reach a certain level of capabilities, and now it's over. And they are obviously not intelligent, right? And if you add more data, you are not going to change this anymore, because of the non-ergodicity of the systems that you are trying to mimic.
Okay, so then the term artificial intelligence is a bit of a misnomer. It's just sexy marketing.
Yes, it's only marketing. Now, I've been using it since 1998 to make a living. So I'm also a bit guilty, but I've never aggressively used it.
You're using it as a tool.
Yes, and I say to everybody so I've also had commercial failures, because I said to customers, no, it's not a magic wand. It's applied mathematics. These are the limitations. And then they went to another vendor who promised them manna from heaven, and then they wasted their money. I've seen so many, many projects where millions and billions have been spent for that could have been saved if people would be more careful and understand better what's going on. And actually, in Russia, they're not so wasteful. And you know why? Because they don't have the same financial systems we have. Our financial system is very prone to waste because fresh money is getting printed, and then the fresh money can be misinvested and you don't feel the pain so much, at least while you're pumping up the bubble, right? And at the moment, we are pumping up a gigantic AI bubble, which will burst at some point. Then there will be great disillusion. And then suddenly people, it's only applied mathematics, right? Told you before, it's only applied mathematics. So this is just the soberness that you need when you deal with this topic. And I think we live in a time of hype where soberness is lacking in many areas.
You know? Yeah.
You are actually very sober. I like this about you.
I'm drinking water, if that's what you mean.
I mean more your person, you know.
But so, correct me if I'm wrong, Jobs. What you're saying ultimately is that AI, machine learning, it's all just a tool, like a knife is for eating.
It can very be complicated used, tool.
It can be used for both good and bad.
Yes. Yes.
Right. But it will never take over.
No, it can't, because it can't have a will. It can't have consciousness. It's just a sequence of symbolic operations. That's what it is, right? And these symbolic operations totally depend on the human observer. So if a cat looks at what a computer is printing out, it makes no sense. So everything computers do depends always on the human observer. It doesn't make sense to the computer. It's just performing a series of mathematical operations. That's all. And that's a great tool, and it will become. I mean, I'm not saying so. In the last chapter of the book, we point out to what extent this will increase and deepen the Industrial Revolution. We can apply it to many. I do this professionally. You know, I head the research department of a biotech company, and I use AI wherever I can. It's great. It saves money and time, and it has many advantages. So we are doing drug discovery, so it speeds up the discovery process, not to a great extent, but it does to some extent. So it's great. You have to know it. It's useful. If you don't use it, you have a competitive disadvantage. Yes, all of this is true, but that's it. That's all it is.
All right. So if AI cannot take over, can it be used to take over segments of society?
It can be used as a tool for rule, certainly. One area where it is, because AI is mostly, we will not see many physical AI applications. Like, for example, I mean, in factories, they are full of robots and AI is managing the robots, but that's a different story. But outside in the open world, every car of these companies, I always forget the Waymo or how they call it, that drive around in San Francisco or Los Angeles, every single car has a human pilot. It's called self-driving, but in reality, it's just a drone on wheels that is supervised by a human being. And as soon as it deviates from its trajectory, the human being has to intervene. So these are not self-driving cars. They are all supervised. And so we won't see many AI usage moving around. However, there's a lot of AI usage in information flow control. And that's where, as you already pointed out, it can be used as one of the tools to exert control over human beings. So it's a means of power. That's for sure.
And money.
So money, that's a good question. So can you make money with AI? So far, not so much. So because OpenAI, because OpenAI, for example, you know, is not a profitable company.
And DeepSeek is free.
Yeah, so that's another thing, that because in the ultimately AI, these LLM models are not so hard to make, right? I mean, it costs some money to train them. So you cannot do this, you know, with a normal computer. You need a lot of hardware, or you need to rent the hardware. So it costs millions to make these models, or even it depends on what you want to do. If you want to train, if you want to have, you need human annotators for many of the properties of the good AI systems. And it may, for example, be that DeepSeek stole the outcomes from OpenAI, because the outcomes require a farm of human beings creating instruction examples for the machine. And so this is very expensive. So this is why they are not so cheap to make, but in the end, it's possible to make them. And so there's competition, and there can be different models. But to make money with AI is rather hard. And why is this the case? I think it can be only, the main usage is for to save human labor in some areas. And I think the extent by which this can be done is in the lower double digit percent, like 10%, 12%, 15%. In some tasks is even less, but not very much human labor can be reduced by AI because it's so unflexible. And most human tasks are quite flexible, more flexible than one thinks. But so it can be used to save costs. But this also takes time to implement, mainly because of human resistance against it. But to make money is not so easy with it because financial markets are not predictable, right? So for trading, for example, it's not very good.
So if we know that there will be these sort of globalist elite types, the technocrats who want to use AI to try and control certain segments of society, and we know that this is going to play out, can we also use AI to buffer against it?
I think the best, well, in the end, you know, the best way is if you were living in the 1510s, you know, and you were submitted to this propaganda that you need to buy these letter indulgence letters so that your soul is not going to be cooked in hell and so on. Basically, the main way to deal with this was to make up your own mind, you know, and that's still the case today. So I don't think that if you look at there are only 7 or 8 sites into which 95% of the internet traffic is going. Google, Amazon, Netflix, I mean, there are very few sites, and this is not going to change. That has complex reasons, but it has to do with network effects. And so therefore, and all these are already filled up with AI. It's going to improve, it's going to be more subtle, and it's going to have an influence. So what do you do to avoid this? Well, you know, you use different sites. You leave Google and go into a primary source that was written by a human being. It can even be Wikipedia, but in many areas, Wikipedia is now full of propaganda. But then, you know, I own. So if I want to have unbiased knowledge, I own the last printed edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And then I look, if I realize that something is full of propaganda in an internet article and I cannot quickly find, I go to my Encyclopedia Britannica, and there I can still find very good basic information. And then the more you know, the better you can navigate. So it's all about what Immanuel Kant says. Enlightenment means to step out of one's own illusions and lack of knowledge, and to take one's mind into one's own hand and to work oneself through it, you know. And I think that's what we have to do. We have to use our individual strength.
Something else you say in your book, which is very funny actually, is firstly, AI is not new. It's just a term that's been given to machines effectively that work with algorithms like ovens or microwaves or fridges or whatever. But I love the comment that you make where you say, well, if it's so scary, how come it's always been so rubbish?
Yeah, I mean the point is that I think this fear of AI, there are several motives. One motive to raise fear of AI is also to incite a regulation that protects monopolies. So if you have invested billions into AI like OpenAI has, you now want to prevent your competitors from also achieving this. So you want to have regulation that makes it harder to enter into the market. So this is a very classical topic. In established industries, they always pay regulators and lobby regulators to regulate the market, to make it harder and harder for competitors to enter. That's called raising the barriers of market entry. And that's, so I think one element of why the AI fear is raised so much is that the regulators are mostly, you know, not very knowledgeable. And then the AI company owners pay experts like me, but not me, but experts like me, to tell the regulators how dangerous all this is. That's why I never get invited to expert panels. You know, but I don't mind. I mean, that's how it is, you know. But these experts said, oh, it's also dangerous. But in the end, that creates regulation that makes it harder for competitors to enter. I think that's a major reason why this AI scare hype is there. You know? But the other is...
Yes, yeah. I was going to say, but the point that I was making is that for decades, we've had some type of AI in our lives, and it's never really been very scary.
Yes, yes. This is another aspect. Yes, thanks for pointing this out. So basically, but the point I was making is also important, but this is very good. So basically, AI is just applied mathematics. It's very good at certain things. At others, it's complete rubbish. So short-term weather forecast has become really good now, you know, and now they are also using AI models. But now it's saturated. And long-term weather forecast on a global scale is complete rubbish, right? We know that. And we know that epidemiologic modeling, it only works for very few organisms, and so on. And so we know the limitations. And it's interesting that despite this, the hype is so big. And I think that has to do with a fundamental misapprehension of technology. It's the same for example, genetic engineering. It's the same. There's also big hype around, oh, soon we can create humans with high intelligence or stronger bones or whatever. All this is just shows that the people who say this, like Klaus Schwab in the Fourth Industrial Revolution, it's a book full of rubbish, which shows his total ignorance of technology and science. And also Harari, you know, Homo Deus is the same. Complete nonsense. He's a historian, you know. God damn it, he has never stood in a laboratory and made an experiment, never solved the differential equation, never solved an integral. These people know nothing, you know. That and so then they speculate, and this is at the moment very fashionable, but it will also change. It's a culture phenomenon of overestimating what technology can do.
Okay, yeah, so I mean, basically what you're saying is that enjoy the technology and be aware of what humans are doing.
Yes, exactly. And this is, this is a very most fundamental philosophical question. How do you lead a good life? I mean, for me, my faith, I'm a Christian, is very important, but this taken aside, that doesn't work for everyone. But this taken aside, you lead a good life by spotting the bad influences on your life and eliminating them. And of course, digitization, AI are now becoming worse and worse as influences on your life. So, you know, you should avoid them. You should spot this and avoid this. And that's possible. And if this is done collectively, that can bring down power structures like Gandhi did this in India, right? So if people like look at I call them heavy battery cars. Look at the heavy battery cars, the so-called electric cars. They are now, nobody is using them. So there's a collective refusal of using this technology that it will disappear. So basically from this example, which is actually not talked about very much because they advertise it so heavily, you know, and now it's petering out. And you can see the strong effect of people refusing to use technologies collectively.
So those robots that Elon Musk launched from Tesla or whatever they were, they look very creepy, but they're effectively useless.
Which ones do you mean?
Those ones that walk around, the ones that you're saying that they can become domestic workers in your house or whatever.
Yeah, I think it's very, very hard to achieve this because in a normal household, you have a lot of erratic events going on. And you can see this that in my household with five children, when they were all rather small, you know, and they were... There was shouting and crying, tears all the time. They were, you know, running into each other on the staircase and dropping a dish, breaking into pieces. I mean, it's so chaotic. Human beings are chaotic, you know.
You don't need kids. All you need for an erratic household is a wife.
Yeah, or two people. And even, you know, even one person alone can create quite a lot of chaos. So I think it will be very, very hard to have robots moving alongside human beings. You can see this from the self-driving cars, which have supervisors, each of them. Now, what is a domestic robot useful for if it needs a human supervisor, is supervising it all the time? It's I think the complexity, they underestimate totally the complexity of the interaction with the complex system that is nature.
You mentioned Elon earlier. What do you make of him? Is he smart?
Yes, of course. He's smart, like Carnegie was smart, or like, you know, Rockefeller was smart. So he's a smart business person. He knows what is trendy very early on and then invests into it before people become aware of it. So basically, he was perfectly, his timing, he obtained 20 billion of subsidies for electric car making when it was super fashionable. Now it's petering out, but he has made a fortune with it, although these cars are completely useless and lose any value after 5 years when the battery is broken. They have zero resale value, but he didn't care. He spotted this and he was completely ruthless also in exploiting this. So he's in a way a business genius. Like these people, all these people who made fortunes. They are, of course, geniuses in some areas, namely spotting business opportunities. But then, with regard to how, to what extent he understands the natural world and understands culture, he's utterly primitive.
Mm. And I mean, do you think he's actually a rocket scientist?
No. I mean, he has a degree in engineering, a bachelor, but his strength is not his scientific or engineering thinking. His strength is to spot business opportunities. And there, one must say, he's maybe among the top 100 most gifted people of the last 100 years. Mm-hmm. But only in this area. You know, like Einstein was not a good businessman, but Einstein was a genius in physics. And mm-hmm. so he's a genius in business, but that's all. But geniuses in business in our capitalist culture are overestimated. Just because they made a fortune, everybody thinks they should also be good at other things. No, they are not. They have a certain talent, and he's super gifted at that talent. And I respect this. But everything he says when he talks about culture or science, it's just laughable. He has no clue.
Well, he also has a gift for getting into politics. Clearly.
So this is, I mean, this, yeah, so what you observe now is very interesting. So let me make this remark. So in feudalism, the people who owned the country, the nobility was also the ruling class. Then in democracy, there was a period over the last 60 to 70 years since World War II where those who were in charge of administrating power, like the elected presidents and the parliaments, they were not really the rulers, and the real rulers were hidden. Right? Now, Elon Musk is part of the people who are really have power. These are the big owners of big fortunes. They have the real power in modern societies. And his appearance on the political scene means that there seems to be a slight trend shift that now very rich people again also appear on the political scene. So the Rothschilds, since 1880 or since 1870, have not appeared anymore in Europe on the political scene. They did before, but then they have, for 150 years, they have disappeared. And Elon Musk is the first example of some, and also Bill Gates to some extent, or George Soros. There are examples for rich people who appear on the political scene. Now, one has to say this with some caution, because they are not the very richest. Mm. Right, there are much richer families that don't appear on the political scene, but he's like a baron, you know, like a lower nobility, and he's now be sent to the political scene. And I think that has to do that we are now witnessing a certain belated attempt of the West for restoration, to restore its old power. And this is belated because they've auto-destroyed for the last 20 years, and now they are losing a very important war, and that wakes them up. And they are now trying to restore some of the power of the West. And that's also the reason why Elon Musk is now sent to the front of the political debate.
So do you think Elon Musk is dangerous?
Not very much. So what is dangerous, I think, in our world is the confrontation between power blocks as the power relations get redefined. So this is always dangerous in history. When new powers arise and old powers decline, that's always very, very dangerous. So if you look at Europe in the first half of the 20th century, most of the danger came from the massive rise of Germany. This created a lot of tension because Germany was never important since 1648. Germany was not so important. They were culturally important, but not politically. And then Germany became super important, and that created a lot of tension. And I think, so this is one danger. And then the other big danger, this is a danger of foreign policy. And then there is a danger of domestic policy that comes from overextent of power like we saw in COVID.
So circling back to the discussion around machines and AI, all of this is part of the 21st century culture, but it's not actually anything to fear.
So we have to fear homo homini lupus. The man is a man's wolf, that Thomas Hobbes said. We have to fear each other, right? We have to fear the evil, the violence, and the will for power and lust for power, and also sadism that powerful people have, enjoying to see others suffer, enjoying to make others feel pain, you know. This we have to fear. And the machines are one way, a powerful way of making the reach of these people bigger. So we have to fear this and the way that the machines and the robots and what all the digital equipment enlarge their radius of and their power. That we have to fear. But ultimately, we have only to fear the evil that is in man.
So do you think, Jobs, that AI will ever be able to make an ethical or a moral decision?
No, never ever. Certain. It's certain because to make it, you need to have a person, to be a person. So a dog cannot make an ethical decision. A child cannot, a mentally handicapped person cannot. And even machine cannot.
Let me just jump in there. Sorry. Okay. So if I go right now into ChatGPT and ask a question about, I don't know, let's just make up a scenario about enslaving a 10-year-old child, it will come back to me with what appears to be an ethical answer.
Yes, of course. It will be what it will do is calculate based on the series of symbols that you have inserted into it. It will calculate another sequence of symbols without understanding what it does. And this sequence of symbols will be in accordance with the consensus of the training material and the way it was trained. So, for example, if you have like Google Gemini was trained to only show black people and women. So it showed... It showed female popes and black popes. It even showed black SS soldiers in SS uniforms, right? And so, you know,
it also showed the first Europeans to land in the Western Cape of South Africa to be black.
Yes, yeah. And if the society, if most of the material that is used for training has some ethical conviction, the machine will reproduce it. But if you engage it into a real discussion about ethics, it will fail, and it will fail because it can't understand it and has no will and no means to compare values. It has actually the source of ethical decisions are values we have, and it has no way to have values and feel those values. If you make an ethical decision, you feel the values and you have a certain set of values that you balance against each other, and then one of the values will prevail over the other, or a combination of values, and that's when you decide this beggar deserves some of my money and this beggar doesn't, right? And machines can't do this because they don't have a value system.
This is an incredibly uplifting conversation, Jobst. As we come in now for a landing, give me a nugget of wisdom.
So the best nugget of wisdom I can give is if you're not become a Christian, and to do this, read the New Testament, start with Luke. and now if you don't want to do that, the second best option is to start reading great philosophical texts, which also just are an incredible source of wisdom. And the best one that is most accessible to many people of our time is Arnold Gehlen's book Man. It's just called Man by Arnold Gehlen. It's relatively easy to read. It was written in 1940, so it's not as old language as Immanuel Kant, but it contains tons of wisdom. And so this is my nugget of wisdom is read the Bible or read a good philosopher.
And understand that the machines will never take over.
Yes.
How can I follow your work, Jobst, or get your book?
Yeah, so the book is now out of press. So in May, there will be a second edition, which is actually a great achievement. I'm very proud because such books normally never get a second edition. It's very unlikely. So it has a second edition, which Barry and I wrote it. Barry is my friend. He's a philosopher. We wrote it together. And second edition will be available in May. You can also buy the first edition online as an electronic copy. But since there's a second edition, I would not recommend this, but I would recommend you to wait. If you want to follow me, I am on X, but I don't post very much. I'm also on LinkedIn. But if you really want to know what I do, you should follow me on Google Scholar, because a lot of what I do is scientific publication. And then, you know, if you Google me, you will also find I write regularly also articles about philosophy of the state. And you heard some of it in our conversation. These you find if you Google my name.
I didn't ask you earlier, but what is your background?
Oh, I studied medicine, biochemistry, and mathematics.
Oh, okay. So you aren't very smart.
I have always suffered from my intellectual abilities. It's true.
I want to get a copy of your second edition, but an actual hard copy. I don't want the digital.
I promise if you send me your postal address, I send you one as soon as I get I get 10 free copies, so I send you one as soon as I get it.
Jobst Landgraeber. I hope I said that right again. Thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Perfect. Thanks a lot. It's great. You're doing great work. Keep it up.
If you enjoyed this, please visit germwarfare.com.